Okay, today is April 24th, 2015. This is the second interview with Linda Newman. Excuse me. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Linda, for sound quality purposes, could you say your name and then spell your last name?
Yes, this is Linda Newman, and my last name is spelled N-E-W-M-A-N.
Thank you. I think we're going to be fine. I just want to...
You bet.
Okay, as I mentioned before we turned the recorder on, I'm really interested in talking to you about your early years on campus.
Right.
And if I remember right, you started here as a graduate student in the early 60s?
1962.
Okay, 1962.
That's when I came here.
So if you wouldn't mind starting by answering the question, you know, why UW and why 1962?
Okay, of course. In 1962, I graduated from Pembroke College and Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, and that spring, Rosemary Perel, who was the new dean of Pembroke College, called a group of us together to tell us that if any of the graduating class of 62 were to go on to graduate school, maybe it was earlier than the spring, but anyway, maybe fall of 61, we would be the ones to go. Nobody, I mean, this was the 60s, nobody had suggested to me that I might go to grad school. What I was realizing, I did an undergrad major in English literature at Brown University, was I didn't know anything. So it was a very wonderful idea to go to grad school. Talking to classmates, women classmates since then, but also in my experience working on this campus, there was a fair amount of gender bias as to who got advanced degrees in those days. not women. But she was very encouraging, and she was a dean. And I wanted to study history. So I thought about studying English literature, but my mother, who was a scholar in her own right, finished her bachelor's and that was it, but said, no, you need to study history. So, well, okay. So I applied to Brown and to Yale and to Wisconsin, and I got in here. So it was a huge turning point, but somewhat, you know, when you ask three, may I come, and one says yes. So we drove across country, and I moved in with a new graduate student, Mary Van Wilkins, from North Carolina, who was studying with Wiley. And she was friends with my boyfriend. So he knew her from Unitarian summer camp. So as I recall, I went up to Bascom Hall as bravely as I could manage and went into the history office, which was overseen, I'm pretty sure, even then by Mrs. Dick. And Merrill Jensen was the chair. And I went into Merrill Jensen's office, and he was an imposing figure of a man then. And he said to me, as I recall, "So, are you colonial or revolutionary?" And I said, kind of weakly, "Colonial. Well, then you go down the hall and talk to David Lovejoy." So I did. And as it turned out, David Lovejoy had gone to grad school, I think he went to Bowdoin in Maine, went into the Army, came back and did his graduate work at Brown with Ed Morgan, as Lovejoy might refer to him, I certainly wouldn't have. So we had that in common, and we also had, as it turned out, a tremendous amount in common. We became enormous friends. And I was admitted to the PhD in U.S. history at Wisconsin without a history major, but I had, thankfully, in retrospect, taken an amazingly powerful U.S. history course from James Blaine Hedges at Brown, who was very near and dear to David, and had a great deal to say about the Articles of Confederation and Merrill Jensen, which became meaningful to me as I started here, I was in Lovejoy's graduate seminar, but I took a fair number, thank goodness, of undergraduate history courses since I didn't know a whole lot of U.S. history. I don't think I knew to realize how little world history I knew. There was the U.S., right? So I did lectures, at least two, if not three, lecture courses with Merrill Jensen in classrooms in Bascom. We had, and I'm not going to have the chronology, I was a grad student from 62 maybe through 68, and I worked part of that time, which I'll talk about, in the department. I married a fellow graduate student. We have a son, and he was born in 67, so I'm not quite sure how all of the chronology goes. But I worked consistently with Lovejoy, worked on a master's thesis, finished a master's thesis the year that Lovejoy was on leave, and James Morton Smith was here and served as my thesis advisor. And my thesis committee, as I remember, was James Morton Smith and Merle Curdy, and I'm not sure who the other member was. And Smith was very clear in saying to me, yes, this is a good piece of work. Our chief task here is to say, yes, we think you can go on and do the PhD, and we do. And so I was encouraged at that point. I did not finish, but it's no, you know, that's a later decision. We had William R. Taylor, I think, had come and was here before he went on to Stony Brook in New York, and he was doing Curdy's task, so doing History of American Thought, more or less. Those were the books that Curdy had written, some of them. And let's see, I'm trying to sort through. Cronin, David Cronin, who went on to become the Dean of Letters and Science, taught recent U.S. history. So I know I did that course. And then, because I was a graduate student in U.S. history, I also was a research assistant. So I worked for maybe 1 year, I think it might have been a year, I worked for the History of Wisconsin Project, which was housed in the State Historical Society. And when you came to study U.S. history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, it turned out that you also came to be what I might call an acolyte in the Historical Society, because there's no institution like it anywhere. And I knew, as I look back now, I knew that the city of Madison consisted of Broome Street, where I had an apartment, walked from there to the top of Bascom. It was, in those days, 30 below on the thermometer. Friends who'd come here from Texas to go to grad school and had a car, you took your battery out of the car at night. And at the top of the hill, of course, you got to sit and listen to Merrill Jensen. So what more could a person want, really? Let's see. So I worked for Larry Larson, who worked in the History of Wisconsin Project along with Charles Glob and with Alice Smith. But I worked, my employer was Larry Larson. And the dating for my time in graduate school goes something like this. In the fall of 62, we had the Cuban Missile Crisis, as I remember. So that was an era when you were working on your paper for your graduate seminar saying to each other, and we're doing this because, I mean, the world's ending, you know, how much difference is this going to make? But we managed to persist, and lo and behold, you know, here in 2015, the world is still with us, thank God. Let's see, who else would I have studied with? Not necessarily. I worked for Leon Litwack in this historical, I mean, I was doing research on his behalf, looking at, I think, Black Lives in the United States post-Civil War. I think that's the book he was writing, on which I was doing some of the research while I was a graduate student. I taught for Larry Vesey, and Larry might have taken Taylor's job and would have held the American Thought, American Culture position before Boyer came, because Boyer, I don't think Boyer came until after I was back in the department as an advisor, as the undergrad advisor. Oh, and I liked Taylor tremendously. I liked his course very much. Wasn't so crazy about Cronin. And then my friends were people who were getting like a PhD from Cronin or from Wiley. We were a pretty tight-knit group, and I married one of Jensen's students, which makes Jensen more of a, he and his wife were extremely kind, as was David Lovejoy and his wife, Bette. And his daughter was a Unitarian and therefore friends with, I think, friends with my boyfriend from Brown, who did not go on to grad school. Oh, yeah, he did. He went on and got an MFA, but that's a whole nother story. So I'm just trying to think what else might be of interest. I was working in the Historical Society when Kennedy was assassinated. And I remember Larry Larson coming out of the office. They were up on the third floor over in a wing with all of the faculty carols. And Larry Larson walking out of an office and saying to me, they shot the president. And I said to him, the president of what? And this, then I just remember being glued to the television set to watch everything that we all watched in the aftermath of Kennedy's assassination. And I was a TA for, I'm not going to remember this guy's name at the moment. And he was teaching the, it was Paul Glad. I was a TA for Paul Glad. And he was teaching the second half of the U.S. survey. I don't think I taught for him for the first half. Maybe it was the first half. I was teaching in the fall of 66 because I was pregnant and the baby didn't. My baby didn't come until after the end of the semester, and my undergrads were telling me, oh, Mrs. Bowling, we really wanted you to have this baby before we had to take the final. And one of the challenges then in teaching were my students who would, I mean, not many of them, but one or two who came after me with the notion that if I gave them a good grade, they wouldn't have to get drafted. And I was very clear that one grade was not going to make the GPA shift enough, and that I wasn't in the habit of giving grades out. And I remember, I think, saying and thinking this was a very wise thing to say, that if one gave grades based on your reasoning before you took the course, then we'd have a different kind of experience while everybody trotted forward to tell me why they in particular needed an A. But let's see. Possibly, and now the calendar is a little fuzzy for me, but my then husband, who was getting his PhD with Jensen, did his, we had special fields and minors as part of our graduate degrees, and Kenneth did his minor or special field in wildlife ecology, which came back to me today walking in. I'm probably going to start to cry. And seeing McCabe's book about Aldo Leopold in a display right when you came into this library, because yesterday was Earth Day. And we were all very involved with the first Earth Day, which may have been, by then I may have been working as the advisor in the history department. That's what I'm not remembering, sort of where the shift came. Let's see. And Paul Glad was a wonderful historian. And somewhere along the line, the department moved down into the humanities / Mossy building. One of the people I worked with as a graduate student was William Appleman Williams. And he was extraordinary. And I, to some degree, credit him with my decision to apply to Wisconsin. My parents had very good friends then living, I grew up in Connecticut, and my parents had very good friends living, I think, in Norwalk, a couple. And we were visiting them after Christmas at some point during my undergrad years, and they hadn't opened their Christmas presents yet, which I found inconceivable. I mean, it was after December 25th. What was their problem? But one of the presents they had opened was a book by William Appleman Williams, and we were all, my parents and they, were very left-wing people. And I started to read, cannot remember the name, I think it was a general history that Bill Williams wrote, but I started to read it, and it was just glorious. I mean, I didn't have much historical perspective, but I loved the way he wrote. So I am positive that's why I applied to come to Wisconsin. He was a diplomatic historian. I didn't know from those kinds of categories. So when Jensen said colonial or revolutionary, I'm positive colonial was the right choice. But perhaps if I had known that Williams taught diplomatic history, and if I'd had the book in my mind, I might have said diplomatic, which would have been a mistake. The reason that colonial history was correct for me is that I turn out to be, looking back, a student of religion. So that I looked at my master's thesis, in my master's thesis, I looked at, it's not precisely religion. Yeah, it is. I'm getting confused between what I did with my master's and what I did with my dissertation research. I studied the Great Awakening in Connecticut and looked at its impact on the relationship between church and state, because Connecticut had a state, it would not have been the state, lowercase s, established the Congregational Church. And what that meant was you were paying taxes to the Congregational Church. And there were people writing into Hartford to complain about that. And my mother, God bless her, went and copied out a lot of those letters, which I used, petitions I used as part of my master's thesis, along with the writings of Elisha Williams. And in the course of researching the master's thesis, was able to get a small glimpse of what an extraordinary institution the State Historical Society is. They had the largest collection of printed materials about United States history anywhere in the world, and I imagine they still do. So they were wonderfully helpful, old, as I knew it then, before I started studying theology after I retired, histories of Connecticut and histories of the colonies that were very, very helpful to me in putting together the thesis that I did write. So I'm not sure. I mean, the other thing that I thought about, trying to think, we hired somebody from Vanderbilt, and now I'm mixing up the, this would have been when I was a grad, when I was the undergrad advisor. Part of what happened, which Troy reminded me of, was while I was here, was the Vietnam War. And I was part of demonstrations up and down State Street to the Capitol to try to persuade the United States to withdraw. And it felt as if we'd made that decision with Johnson. I don't know. I haven't particularly studied it since. What I do remember, when I was the undergrad advisor, part of my responsibility in that role was distributing course evaluations. And I was distributing the course evaluation. This is where I'm stuck now with who this guy was. He preceded Boyer in the sort of Curdy, but it wasn't Taylor. I don't think it was VC. I think he may have left here and gone to Vanderbilt. In any case, he was lecturing on the era when there were lots and lots of protests. And it was the Humanities Building, and he was saying to his students, there are National Guard soldiers outside this building. And then he paused and he looked at them and he said, if you can believe that. And I thought, whoa, well, it's not the way I would have taught that particular bit of history, but I'll just keep, you know, distributing the evaluations. It just depends on where you're sitting when these things happen. I feel as if I was conscious as a grad student of what, you know, the Historical Society was pretty amazing. I certainly loved Bascom Hall. I don't feel particularly one way or the other now that it's become administrative, or that, whether that's, you know, wonderful or just what it is. But also that it was an incredible history department. And the other graduate students, partly, I was saying before we started recording, Stanley Cutler, who taught constitutional law, passed away the first part of April here. And he was a new professor when I came as a grad student. The kind of energy, that's the only way I can describe it, among the graduate students, mostly I knew the U.S. graduate students, was wonderful. And certainly I have some friends who've, you know, gone on and had a career and been successful, and in my advising work bumped into, recently, I mean, in the last two or three years, bumped into a student who had studied with Dick Cone, who had a career at the University of North Carolina, and this person was his undergrad student and then was here as a grad student but also working as an advisor. So that was just a fun encounter. So is there something you can think of to ask me?
Sure. I have quite a few things I think I can ask you.
Okay.
And I want to back all the way up to the beginning.
Okay.
And ask if you've reflected upon how you gained an interest in or a love of history.
Oh. Well, I think it goes back to my parents. My parents were, I have come to understand, intellectuals. So they read a tremendous amount and they had opinions forever, as did their friends. And most of them would at that time have described themselves as communists. So there was in our family, particularly my mother, but my dad too, really, a sense that you don't understand anything except historically. And it's been something of a shock to me as I've grown up that there are a whole lot of people whose perspective is ahistorical. My mother had gone to Smith and actually studied with Merle Curdy. And got revolutionized, so to speak, by his lecturing on the Scottsboro boys, young men, who were falsely accused of rape. And in response to that, when my mother graduated from Smith in 1935, she went to the Soviet Union. Coming back from the Soviet Union, she went to New York City and worked for a taxi company that went on strike, and that's where she met my dad, who I think would have come back from having fought in Spain against Franco. So that growing up, I went out and campaigned. I think I was, 7 years old, for Henry Wallace for president. So that we had, and lots of our friends came and talked politics. And in some ways, my reaction to that piece of it, because when you're, my experience of my parents being communists is you always know who's right and who's wrong. And I hate that. And it took me a long time to sort of come back around to being as passionate about racial and social and economic justice as I am now. I'm ferocious about that. But I'm very, very, very skeptical about labeling anybody as right or wrong. I mean, we stopped talking to my best friend's family when the Soviet Union went into Hungary. And never made any sense to me then. It doesn't now. And it was my mother who really said, no, you can't study English literature. You have to study history. And fortunately for me, when I was studying English literature at Brown, and then I did American Lit here as my minor in the history department, we studied literature very much contextually. So it wasn't so much of the new criticism. I bumped into that, where you're supposed to just look at the poem and it was supposed to tell you stuff. The other piece of my PhD was a special field. And for that, I cobbled together medieval history. So I studied with David Herlihy and I studied with Gaines Post. And through them, I began to get this tiny inkling that the United States wasn't all there was of human history, thankfully. I mean, thankfully I began to realize that. And through them, I heard about Reynolds, who had been a very renowned medieval historian. And we had, I've also been trying to remember this, who this guy was, we had a visiting scholar when I was a graduate student who was a Southerner with a huge reputation. I took the Civil War course with Richard Courant, so he was a pretty substantial, I don't think we had any bad historians here. Courant was an historian of the Civil War and was himself from North Carolina, as was my roommate who was studying with, can't remember Wiley's first name, and he was the one of the people who put UW Parkside together. So he was one of those faculty people who sort of drifts off into administration or decides to go into administration, which was what Dave Cronin did also. But I can't remember the name of this very renowned Southern historian from whom I studied
I took a Civil War course. And, I mean, there's another one. There was a very famous Civil War historian whom I didn't study with, but I can't remember who he was, and lived in Shorewood. So you began to get a sense of lives beyond the campus. So do you have another question?
Mm-hmm. So, and this again goes back, because one should never assume, but I assumed anyway, that you grew up in Connecticut, grew up in New England, that
yes.
might also be a part of your interest in history.
Oh, absolutely, and thank you. I mean, very, very much so, and much more, again, I took it for granted. So in my mom's going to Smith, and her, it's wonderful to realize how powerfully this is her, I miss her. She had studied with a sociologist at Smith who studied the Grimke sisters, and then when Gerda Lerner came on staff and wrote about the Grimkes, my mother was a little annoyed that she didn't give more credit to those professors from Smith. But I also went, she took me to Amherst, which made a huge impression, and to Emily Dickinson's house. So my mom and I both loved literature as well as history. And New Haven. It's not chicken and egg, it's just coming into my head that way. That having decided to study the Great Awakening, and this is the first time I'm really realizing how much that's my home country, and Rhode Island, I mean, when you graduate from Brown University, to this day, the seniors process and go sit in Roger Williams Church. There's only room for us. So 53 years later, and it's still us. But we sat in the church because it wasn't big enough for anybody else. But Rhode Island's history is so much the story of how I first knew the story of the origins of the U.S., that, you know, the Puritans got mad. Some of them went to Holland, and then they came here, and those who couldn't get along in Boston started Rhode Island. And Connecticut was more of a, I think, more of a business, that's not the right, mercantile decision. I think they just moved down the river and made Connecticut and Yale so that they would have more opportunities. And what I am remembering, which is more about how do you do the thing you love, I studied the history of New England without sort of knowing it. My friend Suzanne Desan, who teaches French history, her dad was Belgian and taught in D.C., and she fell in love with France. So she figured, okay, so she's a historian of France. That worked. Wow. Yeah. And my grandmother traces, on my mother's side, traces herself back to the Mayflower, which I knew all the time I was growing up. And my grandfather's, her husband's family back to the Dutch in New York. And in my study of history and growing up, I've become tremendously critical of imperialism and colonialism. And again, only this minute, thinking about, I suppose there's, I'm not sure, you can certainly cast the arrival of the white man in New England as imperial/colonial vis-a-vis the indigenous people. And we had a tremendous indigenous awareness, somewhat unconsciously growing up, just with place names. But again, now that Troy has asked me, we spent huge amounts of our time as kids at the Peabody Museum. So, yes, there were dinosaurs, but there also were American Indian displays. And for as long as I can remember, I've wanted to understand a place, you know, sort of from the geological formation to the present moment, which takes me right back downstairs to Aldo Leopold and Bob McCabe, understanding the ecology. I mean, I think ecology was huge for me. And again, sitting here, it folds into history in ways that I have never thought about before. Mm-hmm. So I've been doing what I was set down here to do, for heaven's sakes, more than I knew. Mm-hmm. And very much in my mother's footsteps. I mean, she should have been an historian. She was a medical secretary. That was how she earned a living. And she was a passionate believer in going away to school and working for a living. And my dad worked for a living until he got fired because he would argue with them about this, that, or the other thing. But I do remember he made a store downtown in New Haven take little black Sambo out of the window. I'm proud of them for lots of reasons. But I hadn't quite realized how much my career grows out of the way I was raised. Mm-hmm. Makes sense, but mm-hmm. I hadn't realized it. So thanks for the question.
So you mentioned ecology, and you mentioned your husband at the time.
Right.
And his interest in wildlife ecology. Was your interest in ecology pre him, or was that a link that came?
Well, what happened for us as a family, because my son was born, is that we bumped into John Steinhardt and the beginnings of the Institute for Environmental Studies. And John Steinhardt and his wife Carol put together what we called a commune. I'm not sure that was quite what it was, but so a group of us. John came before he moved his family. As I understand it, he had a Ford grant and Reed Bryson. There always seemed to be, so I sort of lived inside the creation of IES, and there seemed to be a little bit of tension as to whether it was Bryson or Steinhardt, and I'm definitely in the Steinhardt school. I never examined it objectively. But Kenneth, my former husband, and I joined with John and Carol Steinhardt and some students working in wildlife ecology to create a communal living arrangement first in Middleton and then in University Heights. So it was a 2-year communal living. And Steinhardt's had 3 kids and we had 1, and those were the children. And they were creating IES 101. They had a house on Dayton Street just east of Park that was the IES house. And a lot of them and I worked in 101, IES 101. I worked in it one summer, and Dan Kozlowski was teaching it. He was in ornithology. And we taught 101 and took everybody out to the Kickapoo River and took everybody up to the Apostle Islands. So I was learning ecology collaboratively with Ken, who was making wildlife ecology his minor, and he's a practicing historian yet today with first Federal Congress research project. That's not all of it, and there's a piece of that that sits in the history department in the Mossy Building, which Saladino is a part of that, and Rich Leffler is a part of that. And then Kenneth Bowling works out of D.C. but comes here and teaches archival research and that kind of stuff. So I learned some of that, partly reading Ken's dissertation that he wrote for Jensen. But also, we did a lot of work with, or we collaborated with the people doing IES. Susan Flotter was part of that. She wrote on Leopold, went off to teach at the University of Missouri. And we also were in touch with the Leopold kids. I'm not necessarily going to remember. One of the Leopolds was then administering the Arboretum, but we knew a daughter. And I just remember being part of that group of people who were more science-based grad students on the campus than I was. Ecology became a pretty big deal. And Harriet Irwin was part of all that. She was the daughter of a plant pathologist, I think, here. But those were all the people who were caught up in the creation of IES and then teaching the introductory course. And then when I was an undergrad advisor and working in the School of Ed, I was sending my kids to take those courses, my students.
So you talked about, I think you said apartment on Broome Street.
Right.
You talked about Bascom Hall.
Right.
Historical Society.
Right.
Where else, what other places on campus did you become familiar with?
I worked, now we're getting over into when I was employed. I worked for a while through knowing Steinhardt. He was in the political science department. He had been a science advisor in the White House. And then IES was the Institute for Environmental Studies before it became the Nelson Institute. So I worked for the Marine Studies Center under Bob Rogatsky because Steinhardt knew that job was open, and I think I did that as an LTE. But that meant that I was in space sciences and engineering. So that's I worked there for a while and got to know, made friends with Charlotte Stein, who went on then to be in limnology, so I knew those buildings. And then when you did your research in this historical society, you got to know the Memorial Union really well. So the Memorial Union, I have ever been a let's have coffee somewhere where we usually have coffee. So they didn't have any Pete's. So then I would have been mostly a cafeteria coffee drinker, as I recall. But you just would, you'd be working on your research in the historical society, then you'd go over there and have coffee. And then I would. And then teaching, by the time I was a TA, we must have been, yeah, we were in humanities, because one of the vivid, vivid memories of being a TA, which I might have talked about last time, was being on the assignment committees. So you sat down at the bottom of the all of those graduated lecture halls, and then the undergrads came pouring at you to get their rooms and classes. And then I would teach in the smaller rooms in humanities. And I got to know Helen C. really well, because I think, I've always been crazy about the English department, and I'm not positive if I was as acquainted when I was doing my minor in American Lit. I think I must have been taking classes in Helen C. White. I don't think that building is, they were building humanities. I think I said this the last time when I was pregnant. But I think humanities may be newer than Helen White. Anyway, so the English department is a home space for me across time. And then the house over on Dayton. And then I worked in humanities when I worked in the history department. I don't think there's any place else that was sort of familiar, particularly.
Okay. So, Linda, you've mentioned a couple of key moments in history, if you will, Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy's assassination. There's some key moments on our campus history during that time period. So I want to sort of throw a little word association here.
Sure.
And you shouldn't ask a question you don't know, you know the answer to, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Were you involved in the teach-ins that happened in, I think it might have been 64, 65, related to Vietnam?
No. Insofar as I can remember, I was definitely not teaching them. The question I would have for myself, and I don't know what the answer is, where where I was, I don't mean geographically, because Williams would have been involved with those. And at some point, but I think it was later, I became really good friends with Goldberg, but I don't think I was then. So I remember demonstrating against the war. But, and I know that the teach-ins happened, but I don't know that I was feeling connected enough to this being an undergraduate educational institution as distinct from a place where there were history majors. I think it was still a kind of segregated understanding.
So how about the Dow riot then, October 67?
No, I think I was an observer, which is not doesn't capture the emotion of it. I think I was very, very, very angry and feeling betrayed by the institution, but more betrayed by the country to have been using napalm in Vietnam. And that, so that had to do with, as I recall, the recruiters being on campus to ask people to go over and interfere where we shouldn't have been a presence anyway, as far as I felt. But I don't think I was on the Hill that day. And the images, I think, are images that I have from seeing them in the press, but not from having been there. I remember marching would have been up State Street to the Capitol. And I never went to see the war at home because I didn't trust them. But apparently my son and I are in some of the footage of young mother and child out in opposition to the war. What was very hard for me was the TA strike, because I wasn't a TA. I wasn't quite sure where I belonged, but I was very much a union kid. So you didn't cross picket lines. But I remember struggling even then with how it was that if you were going on to become a professor, how you got to be in a union in opposition to the faculty, which was the way that I understood it as it evolved into the TAA. I think it was very different from the way I understood it at first. And I remember one of the grad students telling me, and this was definitely when I was the undergrad advisor, that I was part of management. And I guess I understand that now. It didn't make any sense to me at all then, but, you know, you live and learn, ideally.
So, where were you at, just sort of in general in your life, in the spring of 1970? And that's, spring of 1970 was Kent State, was President Nixon's making the secret war in Cambodia unsecret. Lots of rioting on this campus.
Phew, boy. I might have been in Connecticut, because it's not... it's not, again, it's not in my, when was, when did the building blow up?
Sterling Hall was August of 1970, so a few months after April-May stuff that went on.
Okay.
And the TA strike was sort of March, April.
Yeah, then I was here. I know I was really, really, I think Ken and I and Andy, our son, who was born in 67, were living in a duplex in the Arboretum along Carver Street out of the East Marsh. So I think I was working on my dissertation, a mom, passionately against the war, passionately opposed to the Army Math Research Center, And I never have, in later years, when I got involved with first Checker Cab and then Union Cab, I was friends with the brother of the guy who ran away. Not Bert, but I'm trying to think of their...
The Armstrongs?
Yeah, I was friends with Carl Armstrong afterwards, because Carl was at Checker and then Union Cab. And then I was friends with him when he ran the juice cart down on State Street. So my sympathies at the time were absolutely with the people who used the bomb. I don't think it's quite that clear cut now, meaning Fasnacht having been killed seemed to me to be, if I would have been asked at the time, I might have said collateral damage. I wouldn't say that now. I mean, I don't think that, well, I suppose the simplest way to be say it is I have evolved into understanding that I'm nonviolent, that violence never does anything helpful, but in the context of my current and pretty much lifelong horror at racism, it's a little difficult to know where you, how you sort of land nonviolent, but that's different. So I think for most of what was going on in 70, I was a very, very impassioned observer and a protester when it seemed like that was something I could do.
So let's sort of change gears, but it's obviously the same time period because you just mentioned a dissertation. What was your dissertation research?
I was studying Benjamin Rush. I got interested in him. I'm not even quite sure why, how. No, I do know. I was working with Lovejoy. He came back from, I think he must have been doing research in England. And I was looking at Rush as a social reformer in the context of the American Revolution. And what I was interested in was to what extent was or was not the revolution about social change. And what I got interested in through studying Rush was the continuity between some changes having to do with understanding mental illness as between the United States, England, and Scotland. So how do you treat people with mental illness? What do you do? And Rush believed in, I mean, it was he had a combination of understandings, which in part had to do with, what do we call that? Temperance and Sunday schools as ways to respond to the impact of poverty in terms of people's learning and ability to negotiate things socially. I don't know that I would have said it this way then. So he had an interest, I believe, an interest in public education, but more than that, an interest in Sunday schools and a very keen interest in mental hospitals with ideas about how you could ameliorate conditions, some of it maybe having to do with bleeding. So I think where I was at that point was the history of medicine to some degree. And I know there was he was writing about having the people in the mental institutions put things in piles as opposed to, you know, as to sizes. And trying to figure out what, if any, relationship there was with the politics of the American Revolution to some of the social ideas, reform ideas that he was promulgating. And I didn't come to any particularly satisfactory conclusion, and my personal conclusion was that I wasn't a scholar, meaning that I loved research. And I had loved, in the context of the masters, reading sermons. And I got very, very caught up and fascinated with Jonathan Edwards. And he didn't play into my master's thesis that much. Well, some, in terms of the Great Awakening. And I, in that context, I got very interested in how in the world do you ever figure out cause and effect? Because the people who were proclaiming the Great Awakening proclaimed it as being the answer to a falling away of energy involved in religion. But I always thought, well, yeah, but you're looking back across the energy peak. So from over here, you might decide that this slow period somehow generated this period, but you don't know that. So that was... And with Rush, it was more how much were the efforts to create humane treatment for people with mental illness in England and Scotland related? And Rush himself, I think, had been educated in Edinburgh or had spent time in Edinburgh. So as with the Great Awakening in religion, it was becoming very clear to me that the sort of the ocean wasn't dividing the transmission of ideas at all, that there was a fair amount of commonality in trends in religion and also in ways to think about how best to manage society. I suppose you could say it that way.
One more thing for today, and you've mentioned a lot of names here. I think most of the names that you mentioned besides your husband's are faculty.
I think so.
And I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind talking about some of your fellow graduate students at this time.
Oh, not at all. the people... Okay, Mary Van Wilkins was in Wiley's seminar, and I'm not sure what she went on to do. Bill Tuttle was one of Cronin's students, and I was friends with a fair number of Cronin's students. Dan Carter is, not sure, he might have been Cronin's student, and he had a significant career. I know I've seen his books. Let's see. There was a couple, and there were some women. Miriam Langsam was a good friend, and she might have been Curdy's student. Marianne Gebeline and Frank Cook were graduate students and then married each other and are here. Jerry Frost went on to teach at Vassar, and I think he was in Lovejoy's seminar with me. Maxine Neustadt, now Lurie, was in Lovejoy's seminar, and she's retired from Seton Hall, and John Lurie, whom I didn't know, but she married him, retired from Rutgers. Dick Hohn was at University of North Carolina. Jim Curtis, these are the Jensen seminar people whom I knew, and Jim taught somewhere in the West. Carey, Fran Carey, that's her married name, and I've forgotten what her husband's, first name was Ron Story. Ron and Ellen Story. Ron Story was one of my best friends, and he was Taylor's student, faculty. Taylor went on to Stony Brook on Long Island, and Ron Story made a very significant career for himself at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, and was friends with Boyer before Boyer and his wife moved here to be on the faculty. Paul moved on to the faculty, and he's passed. Dan? I I didn't know Paul Buell. I knew of him, but I didn't know him. And there's a woman trying to get her to come back into my head who had a big career, and I don't know if she would have been Goldberg's student. And I knew the woman who went on to marry Maury Meisner when he got divorced, but I'm not remembering her name, and she's here.
Well, that's a pretty substantial list. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. That. You're welcome.
And maybe just one more thing on that, and then we'll wrap up.
Sure.
So outside of the seminar or the class that you may have had shared with fellow or took with fellow graduate students,
right?
What sort of interaction, type of interaction did you have with your cohort?
The graduate students?
Yeah.
Parties. A lot of social gatherings. And it was kind of continuous, as I remember it, from when I was first a grad student through getting to know everybody in IES. And the people in IES, we all lived together, as I said, for those couple of years. So you would get together Friday or Saturday night, and you would have something to drink. When Ken and I were living right off Carver Street, we were kind of transitioning from alcohol to pot. So then the parties were slightly different, but not tremendously different. So lots and lots and lots of conversation at parties, and I think dinner parties a lot, but not with anything fancy, that one of us would cook and then everybody would come over and then you'd all go someplace else. And then like Tuttle's were in Eagle Heights, so pretty soon we were cooking and we were bringing our kids together. And lots and lots and lots of conversations. But not so much, I mean, field trip kinds of things would go on for the IES kinds of relationships, but those often were more attached to courses. And we didn't, when it was time to travel, we traveled as a family unit, not more with more extended socializing. Concerts, certainly, lots of concerts. But I'd go with Ken. And a fair number of going out of town to a farm where there'd be lots and lots of music and lots of people. Not Woodstock. We drove past Woodstock. But Wisconsin, Madison's own sort of versions of those, which would have been, I think, late 60s and early 70s.
Okay. Linda, I want to wrap it up for the day. I want to give you space, though, if there's anything on your mind, either from this time period we've been
right.
talking about or
right.
anything on your mind that you're afraid we may not get on the record the next time.
The only thing that I'm learning through the process, for which I'm profoundly grateful, is what an extraordinary history department this is, and how fortunate I feel to be doing this piece of work with the archives as you represent them, for allowing me to carry the torch. I mean, that's really what it comes down to, because I have felt that reverence almost from the minute I walked into Merrill Jensen's office. And I understand myself to be exceptionally fortunate, and I have been telling a lot of the people I care about the first visit here, for how powerful it is to look at all of the people whose lives intersect through the history department, and the changes in terms of the demographics, from tall white men. I mean, and Lord knows they've got a good place, good spot. But the women and the people of color and the stories, I mean, I was having coffee yesterday with Steve Stern, and he's really excited about an historian who's now in the department who's looking at the building, I think it's the building of where it is that the Chicago Bulls play, in terms of its impact on local versus translocal powers in the space it's being set down in or was set down in. And in my head, I was contrasting that with the way that I understand, I haven't read it, Bill Cronin to have looked at the creation of Chicago initially and all of the forces that come to play. And then that takes me to what I do need to say. A couple of things is Bill Williams sending me out to look for the impact of the frontier in American history on the floor of the U.S. Senate, because that's where he was looking for it, was in the rhetoric used at the end of the 19th century. And the story I have to tell you about Bill Williams, I knew I had to tell you how much more important he was than I had yet said, is that when I was in his graduate seminar, he just went to the box of notes like this, and he just took a chunk of them out and handed them to me and said, these should give you a good start. Just, he was incredible. Just, and had been in the Navy and loved the ocean and then went to Corvallis. So it just was like, yes, he had to, Bill had to go home to the water. Mm-hmm. And with Litwack, he had to go back to California because that's where he was from. So the intersection of the personal histories, but most of all, the power of the teaching. They were good. They were good. And still are.
Well, Linda, I want to thank you for the time you gave me today. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
This concludes the second interview with Linda Newman. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.